I'm the dude. All my thrills are answered in the movies.
That's a big Twinkie.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to GMC Episode 19, the podcast that is creating a sex tape with apes. My name is David McVeigh.
Richard. Gray.
I have nothing to add to that, sir. I'm sorry. I'm David.
Hello, David. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. There's two Davids.
It's a mind-bending experience.
Imploding.
This week we took
eyeballs bulging.
This week we took two Davids to see Planet of the Apes. Well, look, more on that later.
Now that you brought that up, we may have to roll straight into that.
No. Leave them hanging, David.
All right, leave them wanting
also,
more.
Also, David,
we'll bury the tail.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Geek Movie Club. We call our club to order. This is the weekly podcast, which is no longer going to be weekly. Funnily enough, it's our fortnightly podcast as of this week.
Why is that, David?
Well, let's just talk a little bit about what's coming up. It is actually, this episode marks the 501st podcast produced by Geek Actually, which I think is always an interesting moment in history. For those who want to know what our 500th... Bit late off the mark, but... if you want to know what our 500th episode was, it was actually Behind the Panels issue 101, which is actually our 500th episode, which we just recorded earlier today. But next week, we are moving into a brave new frontier because it is going to be the anniversary of Geek Actually. It is our 6th year anniversary of podcasting. Yay! On the 28th of July, actually, will be our 6th year of podcasting. So we thought we should mark that celebration with something interesting and fun. So what we decided to do was, listening back over the last few episodes of Geek Movie Club, it occurred to me that the show is actually becoming a little bit like Film Actually. It's becoming a little bit more hard review focused and less fun and chaotic and everything else that it was supposed
to
be.
Don't worry, today's going to be bananas.
Well, yeah. Well, so we thought, well, damn it, let's bring back Film Actually. So I got in touch with Josh. Josh Philpott is coming back, and what we're going to do is we're going to...
So which one of us has to go?
None of you.
Oh, okay.
None of you. So what we're going to do is, as of next week, we start the new rotation of shows. Behind the Panels continues as a weekly show that goes on as always, and then Geek Movie Club and Film Actually will rotate fortnightly. So basically, it'll be a Geek Movie Club one week, a Film Actually the next week, et cetera, et cetera.
So that's three shows that we're doing.
Damn straight.
That almost sounds like a network.
I know.
Because most people celebrate 6 years traditionally with candy or iron as a traditional gift, or wood as a modern gift.
So I have wood right now. So.
Well, I was just thinking like a candy-flavored dildo. It's really what we should bring in.
All of those.
If we can arrange that by next week, that would be fantastic.
So listeners, if you
Josh should really love that, coming back to find a candy-flavored dildo on... his chair.
Absolutely. On his chair.
Where else would you put it?
Well, there is that.
For Flavin.
All right, so that's the big announcement. So next week will not be a GMC. Next week will be a Film Actually, and Josh will be back in the hot seat. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And for those who are keeping score, that will be Film Actually 101.
It's Film Actually 101. Isn't it interesting that Film Actually reaches 101 episodes the same week that Behind the Panels?
Well, the week after, the week actually. After
how did that happen?
I don't know. It's called putting things in hiatus for a while. Anyway, so those who like a good, grounded, I say that with a serious face, film review show, Film Actually is coming
don't
back.
Don't listen to anything we do.
No, don't listen to any of this. And of course, Film Actually, if you remember, actually was kind of chaotic in its own right. And it's going to be even more chaotic because it's going to be a four-hander because we've also got Dave Longo now. So it's going to be very interesting.
A four-hander with candy-colored deals.
We can finally get that daisy chain going.
I'll be the
not,
one.
Not at this desk, we can't. How long do you think my arms are?
I'll carve the wood while you guys are talking.
Oh, dear. Where's this going already?
There's a euphemism. I'm carving the wood while you guys are talking.
So that's our big announcement.
This is why we need a woman on this show.
Episode 200, I've built a canoe.
Oh, and those on and for those who are also wondering, order.
Where's that gavel?
Order. For those who are also keeping score, yes, the Buffy marathon is still coming. Rachel is still watching.
So is fucking Christmas,
don't you? Oh, shut up. We have just delayed it a couple of weeks because we're still trying to organize time zones and getting people on Skype and
She's
stuff.
In Perth, not Swaziland.
It's 3 or 4 hours, dude. We've got other shows to record.
Yeah, fair enough.
So we've got to try and figure all this out. We already spend our entire Sunday recording shows. You know, like,
or drinking tea and talking about recording.
Well, there is that. Yeah. Too. All right, so let's move on and let's talk a little bit. Oh, actually, before we move on, let's talk a little bit about DVD releases because you were just bringing up that they have announced what, sorry?
Oh, well, there's a movie we discussed last week, which was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And they've just announced that they're bringing out a Caesar bust head of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which has got the collection will include the Blu-ray, the DVD, and a digital copy of both Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, as well as a 32-page Planet of the Apes Building an Icon booklet and 4 battle-ready ape character cards. I don't know what that means.
Goodness sake. And screw you to all you have already bought Rise of the Planet of the Apes. You have to buy it again.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not the first time.
No, it's not. Now,
and how many versions? And wait till the version that comes out that's got all of the other Planet of the Apes films plus,
the Evolution Dawn. Collection that's out now, which actually has everything up to Rise. This got me thinking, though, and it's something that's actually been kind of running through my little head for several years now, actually. And I thought, when you mentioned this, you actually said, my God, no wonder people aren't going to the cinema anymore. Because
we know the DVD's coming out.
The DVD's already coming out.
4 weeks time.
It actually got me thinking to a conversation that I actually had with my lovely wife, Katie, not long ago, where I was saying something, and look, I'm an avid movie collector. I got a lot of DVDs and a lot of Blu-rays. But something occurred to me the other day where I went, the problem with the home video market, and this goes all the way back to VHS, is that it's taken special out of going to the movies. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, when I was a kid and going into my teenage years, going to the movies was an event. You actually would go to the movies, you buy your popcorn, you waited for movies to come out. It was like this anticipation for the movie, and then you go to the movie and you watch it, and it was like that was the big event. And since the advent of home video, you still kind of have that build up to it, but it's like a massive anticlimax because once it's come out on DVD, it's now just any other movie.
Jesus, you're old.
I know. but think. Am I the only one that feels this way?
No, actually, I think. But to me, it's movie. To me, kids, it's movie going more generally. Because the whole, and this is why I admire Dave Longo's stance of not watching trailers, because the whole thing was the first time you used to hear about a film was either when you saw the trailer at the cinema, or there was like a 15-minute special they did on TV or something. That was the first footage. Or you read about it in Empire or Premiere or one of the trade rags or something. Pre-internet, kids, we didn't get any footage, any images with it. Now it's kind of like 46 new photos released from the set of whatever, and here's a teaser trailer for the teaser trailer, and here's, you know, the poster and the casting announcements and all this stuff. You know, you've seen the movie in 2 to 3 minute segments in the lead up to the film being actually released. So when the movie comes out, the movie release itself is almost an anticlimax to the marketing campaign that's preceded it.
True.
So you're absolutely right. By the time you get down to the DVD release and the home release, it's kind of like, you may as well have just given it to me on the way out the door.
I pulled a Blu-ray off my shelf the other day and I went, my God, I remember the anticipation and the build-up and everything for this film, and now it's just, here it is.
That's the thing. Even going back, probably the last time that we had genuine anticipation and not a lot of footage for a film was going back as far as The Phantom Menace. Because after that was the movie that probably had the most downloaded trailers in history at the time, and then after that everyone pretty much was on online from early 2000s.
Well, it was the first time we'd seen a big movie just absolutely go nuts on the internet.
And that was the time when internet marketing really, and you started getting video diaries and all those sorts
of things.
The
other film that was huge on the internet at the time as well, which used the internet really well, they put out clips, was ID4, Independence Day.
ID4 did it, yeah. And then Peter Jackson started doing it with his video diaries, which were really good because they were quite teasy, but then that sort of gave way to that whole culture of go show us everything before the movie comes out, and then we'll see the product, you know, when it comes out, which is sort of given rise in turn, and this is where I get really old man, to that culture of entitlement, you know, that kind of this movie sucks already, and it's not the movie I want. Give me everything. Tell me what's going to happen in the film so I can judge it before I see it.
Well, you're almost now validated, you know, in judging it before you see it.
Yeah,
if you feel like you've seen most of it, yeah.
Yeah. Because people like, you see the trailer and it's like 2.5 minutes that shows you the whole film. You go, well, that's going to suck.
Mm.
You can probably be fairly confident that it is.
Yeah. And then if it's really good, you're stuck.
Which is why I really liked, as much as I didn't like the film, I always say one of the best trailers I ever saw in the last couple of years was the one for The Hangover 2, which was just the four of them walking towards camera with some music playing underneath it. It's like coming forward.
Or the first trailer for Godzilla.
Yeah.
The remake of Godzilla, which gave away nothing. You know,
and all it did was just get your pants wet for.
Yeah, absolutely. Movie, and then exactly the second trailer came out, which showed everything.
Mm.
So it's like, oh, well, damn. You know? Yeah. So yes, I do admire your stance about not watching trailers. I'm going to continue watching trailers because I can't help myself because I just love trailers.
Because you like being disappointed.
Yeah, I do. And also, it is actually a feature of Film Actually. We'll be talking about trailers again. Yeah. So it's one of our things on Film Actually is talking about the new trailers. So you're going to have to get ready to pull headsets off a lot.
Okay. But well, we were wondering who we could get rid of.
Bye.
Who was wondering?
Yeah, so it was just.
Why is all my stuff sitting out on the porch?
Because I think you're absolutely right. I think this culture where you go, the film is released and they've already got a DVD release date. You go, well, what's the point?
To the point where everyone's like an amateur box office watcher now. Kind of like there's a poll I'm looking at right now on superhero hype. How much do you think Guardians of the Galaxy will earn in its first weekend domestically? And you can choose everything from 100 million plus down to 1 to 10 million. Well, I'm pretty sure it's going to earn more than 10 million in its opening
week. God, I hope so.
Or more than 1 million in its opening week. I feel fairly confident. It's like, how do you know? How do you know? What are you basing that on, person on the internet?
Yes.
Like, you know, historically, guides, what have you gone out and polled? Have you done a Gallup poll? Have you done a Nielsen ratings thing? Have you gone out and spoken to people? No, you're basing this purely on the idea. It's like, well, I've got the internet. I know stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
And so people come in with these half-baked opinions based on, and that's why you get disasters like John Carter. Because the internet's been telling them that it's a disaster.
And let's face
it,
every man and his dog seems to be a movie blogger now. And, you know, it's...
Hell, we all are.
Yeah, we're. we're just movie podcasters now.
Technically, we all have blogs.
We do.
Whether we update them or not, it's completely irrelevant.
Yes, but there's a certain culture around that, the whole movie blog thing that has become, you're right, this entitled... You know, we're the experts. We're the people who are the tastemakers. No, you're not really. No. You're one person's opinion.
My opinion on the masterpiece that will be Guardians of the Galaxy has will have no sway whatsoever on its box office. I may have convinced three or four people to go and see it.
Now, that being said, you know? Guardians of the Galaxy will be the feature of about five of our shows.
That's because we're massive nerds.
We are. We're huge geeks and nerds, and we just really want to see this movie, which we are seeing, and we will be
That's
reviewing
the kind
it.
Of crap I hate the most, though, where it's like, hey, let's see what it does in 2 days.
This is the Hollywood culture, though.
Knock it off. Like, as you're talking about DVDs, like, what is it now? It's like the movie lives for 2 days and then it dies on DVD on your shelf.
That's
like,
the thing. And it used to be because there was a time when movies would build box office over a couple of weeks because word of mouth.
Well, limited release, opening it to more screens. It would actually build up.
It'd build up. Now it's kind of like when you got every press outlet reporting going, well, the Friday it only made $33 million, so it's disappointment. Everyone goes, well, it must be terrible.
Well, I told Dave this. I told Dave this story a few weeks ago, but I thought we'd talk about it on air. There was a principle in photography, a principle in philosophy amongst releasing of films at one point called the shotgun release. And this was actually pre-internet. This is going back to the days
you'd
when...
You'd get it pregnant and force it to marry you. No.
This was not quite. This was in the days when... they would do their test screenings and stuff, and they would actually see what was going on with a film before releasing. Then they would decide to release it in a certain number of screens and then expand out depending on business and demand. Now, when a film came along in 1981, whatever it was called Neighbors with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, it tested really, really badly. And the studio was desperate to make money back on this film that they knew was a turkey. They had a bomb on their hands, and it was actually one of the first films to instigate what was called the shotgun release. The idea was to release it in multiple screens across the country, all in one hit, get as much box office as possible before word of mouth could actually hook in and then pull it from release. And they did it, and they actually made a hit out of it. They literally released it incredibly wide. They released it everywhere at once, and then just by the end of the weekend, it was gone. And it was like before any critic or any word of mouth could kill the film.
Well, this is what we know when a movie is not going to be terribly good when we get the screening the night before.
Exactly. And the thing is, you can't do shotgun releases now because word of mouth is instantaneous.
Yeah.
It is like, it is literally the armchair critics, the bloggers out there and so forth will literally have that review up as they're going home.
It's the hashtag world.
It's the hashtag world. And it's like, I think that we're seeing a very different, so they have to release every film now as wide. And the philosophy is opening weekend breaks the film. Basically, if they open a film and it doesn't make that instant box office in that first weekend, they know they're sunk.
And I love it now that it's like, I'd only made $50 million on its opening weekend. That's terrible. It's like, well, stop spending so much money on it and make $50 million meaningful.
That's
again.
A very old you argument. Know? That's been you going know, back since don't, the I mean, last like,
couple
you know, decades.
If your lead actor is getting $50 million, you know, that's your opening weekend would have been good had you not paid that person a ridiculous amount.
There was a huge article in Premiere Magazine, if you guys remember Premiere Magazine going back a few years ago. But in Premiere Magazine, there was a huge article about that and had the excesses of spending. Yeah. And it's when Warner Brothers actually had Superman Lives on the slate. This is the one with Nicolas Cage. They released a whole bunch of very big budget films and they all died at the box office, including Wild Wild West and so forth. And Warner Brothers. Yeah, absolutely. Warner Brothers at that time literally pulled every major film off the slate, including Superman Lives, which is one of the reasons why that film died, because they said, we got to stop the spending right now. At this point in time, they just literally just cut everything off, and then they released a whole bunch of low-ticket items, low-rent items, for a good couple of years. Warner Bros. Took a while to rebuild back up to doing stuff like Lord of the Rings and stuff through New Line, because they were really gun-shy for a while there. And their big argument, their big discussion was, we've got to stop spending $30 million for an actor. We've got to stop spending this huge amounts of money because we cannot guarantee a return on these films.
There's no other industry that gambles, you know, 90% of its profit for the year that sort of puts out these
on one person.
There's no other industry that spends $300 million on a product which could potentially die, as you say, within 2 days.
Yeah.
You know,
think about TriStar Pictures back in 1995. TriStar Pictures had a philosophy in 1995 that it was the star who sold the film. That was their single principle. Think back to the posters of all the TriStar films that came out in 1995. Mm. Virtuosity, what was the Denzel Washington film, the jazz film, I can't remember what it was called.
Oh,
Woman in Blue or whatever it was called. Yeah, whatever that thing was called. Anyway,
Devil in a Blue Dress.
Thank you. That's the one. Yeah. You think about all their films that came out that year. They all featured a small something in the corner and a huge actor's face.
Yes.
And every poster looked exactly the same. And that was their philosophy, was that the actor was going to sell the film. And what happened that year? They almost all tanked.
And that's like a return to the studio system.
Yeah. And they completely blew it on that because they were screwed that year. Yeah. You know?
Flip side of the coin, of course, is that if you have a $300 picture that makes $1 billion, well, that funds a whole lot of art house films for the rest of the year. Mm. And then they do feel confident releasing smaller films. And you know when that happens, when the studio, I mean, we would not have Guardians of the, it's not that it's an art house film, but we would not have an experiment, them rolling the dice on Guardians of the Galaxy, had Avengers not been a $1.5 billion picture, had Iron Man 3
not worked, period.
You know, $1.3 billion afterwards, and then another $700 million apiece on Thor and Captain America. You know, we would not have, you know, Disney being able to put out prestige pictures with Tom Hanks making, you know, the making of Mary Poppins and stuff like that. You know, Disney can roll the dice on these smaller pictures because they're making a shit ton of bank, you know, off these large releases, which they're fairly confident will do well.
Which is always
But nobody knows. That's the thing. Nobody knows what makes a hit. If they did, they just keep making them.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. The audience is fickle. The audience has always been fickle. And what is a surefire hit one year is not going to be a surefire hit the next year. Mm. Nobody,
unless it's got Tyler Perry in it.
and you're releasing in North America, because outside of North America, his films don't make any money. Yeah. But nobody could have predicted in 1982 that E.T. would have become the runaway hit that it was.
Given the films that came out in 1982.
Absolutely. And considering also the fact that no studio wanted to back E.T. I mean, it was literally, they went, it's a kid's film. Especially no kid's film is going to make a huge box office.
Especially if they had judged E.T. on its opening weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And think about Batman Begins. Batman Begins opened really soft.
Actually, I always like to think of the example of Highlander, a film that ended up spawning, you know, however many sequels, two TV series, an animated series, an anime film. You know, it opened kind of weak. They weren't confident with the soundtrack and marketing it as Highlander, so the soundtrack actually got released as a Queen album, a standalone album called A Kind of Magic.
Yep.
Suddenly, the movie through word of mouth became a hit. Yet, so there's no official soundtrack to Highlander. Technically, they've released a score a little bit later on, but because they were so scared about that, and it was because the film built up. And it technically flopped. But the thing was, I remember Kevin Smith talking about that when Mallrats opened. And they told him that the numbers came in on the Friday night or whatever. And he goes, okay, so what? Do you think it'll make money on the Saturday, Sunday? They go, no. It's dead now. That's it. Your chance is over. And he goes, but people still go and see movies. We can market it more or whatever. And they go, no, that's it. It's over.
Yeah.
You know, the first couple of days and it's over. You're not.
And 95 was a rough year. That was the year Waterworld was coming out as well. So this was a rough year where things were not working the way that the Hollywood system wanted.
We went through another phase, and that was Warner.
Yeah.
We went through another
phase. No, it was Paramount. It's Universal. Universal,
maybe. Oh, you're right. It was too.
Yeah, that was Universal.
And it was, because of course, the attraction to Universal Studios. Which, I've got to say, the film wasn't a bad movie, but I think the Waterworld attraction is a bigger pull at Universal Studios than the film ever was.
Well, and I don't know if we've ever talked about this on the show, but the famous story in 95 was that the Matsushita company who owned Universal at the time bankrolled Waterworld, which at the time was the most expensive film ever made at $185 million or something like that. It was,
it was massive.
Outrageously expensive, and literally would not make its money back. There was no way for this film to turn profit by the time they had finished it, and it was a rough and this whole schedule, everything about it had caused rifts between Kevin Reynolds, the director, and Kevin Costner, the actor. They were best friends and they were no longer speaking. Kevin Costner had taken over the editing of it. They were fighting. Everything was a disaster with this film. Everything. And then this little miracle happened, if you talk about miracles, where Matsushita decided to sell Universal Pictures. And the company that owned Seagram's alcohol, Seagram's bourbon, basically the head of that company was a massive movie fan. He decided to buy Universal Studios because he just wanted to be a mogul. And so he bought Universal Studios. But one of the conditions of the sale was that Matsushita took the bill for Waterworld. And so basically he bought Universal and got Waterworld free. And so when he released Waterworld at the cinema, which went on to make $200 million, it was all profit. And so basically Waterworld ended up becoming a profitable film because he didn't have to pay for it. And so Waterworld became a hit, even though it should never in any rational mind ever have been a hit. It became a hit.
Well, the other thing about spending that much money on a picture and expecting them to compete throughout a summer is that at the end of the day, it's relying on humans, and humans only have so much money to go around.
Yes.
So we can't see every... if I wasn't in the fortunate position of getting media screenings...
Well, we wouldn't see nearly as many films.
I would see... When I wasn't doing media screenings for a year there, I saw probably about 20% of what I would have normally seen in a regular...
Well, the average person probably goes to the movies once every few weeks.
Yeah.
If that... Okay, when we were doing Geek, actually, when we first started 6 years ago, we'd watch a lot of DVDs and Blu-rays, but we would DVDs back then, but we would literally go to the movies once a week. And we paid, and we would actually go to the movies once a week, and that was the film we reviewed because we were paying for it. So you look at it and go, we're big movie watchers, and we were only going once a week. Mm. Now, on a on a hard week, we're doing screenings two or three times a week. Yeah. And we're seeing a lot of films. We're seeing a lot more films than the average person would watch. And we watch a lot of films that the average person wouldn't watch.
That's why I'm always embarrassed when someone says, hey, have you seen such and such yet? I'm going, no, no, I keep getting around to it. No, I won't. Yeah. But you're the film guy.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a point where Richard and I...
TV as well now.
And it's TV is now, which is like watching, what, a dozen films at home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to talk about a big TV show.
Absolutely. That's basically our feature review this week. We're going to talk about a TV show. In fact, we should probably move on a little bit.
Just finish what you were saying. I think that was interesting.
Which part? I'm old. I forgot already.
That thing about what you were saying.
Oh, that thing I was... I think it's just a matter of we need to reduce the cost of films. If we can reduce the cost of films, we might be able to reduce the cost of tickets to films.
Yeah.
Because
one of the problems
that cinema has at the moment is the fact that it is almost outrageously expensive to go to the movies. And when we're not talking about the individual. The individual goes, all right, $20 a ticket, whatever, right? And now American tickets are cheaper than ours, granted, but still, we go to the movies, we go see a 3D movie in particular, that's $25 a ticket, okay?
And that is the nail on the head, because it's exactly what you were saying before. It's like, where's the magic in cinema anymore? Mm. And so the same thing happened when television first came in. Widescreen was introduced to make it special to bring people back to the cinema. Now, the thing is now, they do the same thing, 3D, IMAX, stadium seating, you know, whatever, VMAX here in Australia. But of course, you pay for the privilege
of going to that
thing. So you're not actually enticing people to come back to the cinema. You've just made it harder for them to come back.
As an expansion on the original topic, which was already releasing Blu-ray details of a movie,
you sit there and go,
well, what's the point in going to the cinema? Well,
my whole family can see it for $25 on my 3D TV in 4 months.
But that's what I was about to say. So the big push was they went everything 3D at the cinema. Why? Because that was an experience you could only get at the cinema, right? So immediately the companies, and we're talking about companies who own cinemas.
Like Sony were putting out 3D.
Exactly. Sony has its own cinema, its own production company. And so they're going, we're releasing big screen movies.
Well, we haven't shot ourselves in the feet lately.
And then, let's shoot ourselves in the foot and let's release a 3D TV, which means people don't even need to go to the movies
anymore.
And
the irony is that it's a Sony film. They'll probably be advertising their 3D TVs in their films.
Yeah.
I think that Marvel's doing the right way, I think. You know, like making movies look bigger and feel like huge, massive event films, but making the costs cheaper.
Yeah, because I don't think the Marvel films
are never that expensive.
They are getting more expensive though now. So
probably because the talent. Because
the thing as well is like there's the public's expectation of the movies, and if the average person goes what 3 times a month or
if that,
the kind of thing is they're gonna want to go to see the big films.
Yeah, you look at 2016 rather. Mm. You got Cap 3 and Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice going head to head. Dawn of the Planet of the Justice. coming out. Like literally there will be a choice. Yeah. Someone will
and
make
I think,
a choice.
I think the way that I feel about it is that these movies they seem to be costing $200 million a piece, right? At minimum. Mm. And the kind of thing is when a movie costs $200 million, the pressure's on.
Yeah.
This has to make it back. And the kind of thing is that if every movie they do, the pressure's that high, then they're going to spend more to make more. And it's this vicious cycle.
Like, you know what, though?
The thing is that if they make movies less and they look less, then the public are going to go, this doesn't look as big.
But do you know what's interesting before? On that?
And the kind of thing is, like, that's the thing. Once you give people cake, they can't
on that argument, though.
I'm having crackers now.
Yeah, but on that argument, though, I will say, look at something like Chef is a great example. Mm-hmm. Chef is a little film.
Yes, but Chef is an outlier, though, because Chef is most likely funded with the money from
Granted, and that's but one of the points we were making before.
How many screens did Chef get released on, and how many people saw Chef?
No, exactly. But the point is that Chef is a film where you sit there and you go, here is a film that by all means is a rental. This is a film that has no reason to be on the big screen. This could have been a telly movie, you know what I mean? But because it is solidly acted, solidly written, solidly shot. And the food stuff is almost central on the big screen. It's got some names in it. You sit there and you watch it and you go, I don't begrudge paying this amount of money on the big screen. We're going to talk a little bit about Sex Tape later where you sit there and go, I would begrudge paying for that film on the big screen. Now, I saw it for free, thank God, because I don't think I would have paid money for that. You know what I mean?
I can hop on YouPorn and see how that sex tape.
Pretty much.
The thing is that movies in general are in a really dangerous place at the moment, I feel. Like, I don't know if you guys saw this, but a couple of...
It's piracy's fault.
Piracy's a big part too. Television's a big part too. Knocking out things like that, distribution models. Now with everybody getting it digital, you're losing this, as Christopher Nolan called it a week ago, the safety net of DVD releases, which could be in part to why they're advertising this Planet of the Apes release really quickly. It's because, like, please buy the DVD, because that's another safety net. That's more income. But the thing is that now most people are streaming it. They're not buying the hard product, and you can't charge $35 for a hard product. Like,
what do you think of the idea then of Bob Iger came up with? And I mentioned this a couple of times on the show before. Bob Iger, the head of Disney, sort of said, well, what about selling the DVD Blu-ray at the concession stand on
the way out,
and that's and giving a cut to the cinema owners, so the cinema owners get their cut of the profits. You capture the market as soon as they're walking out, going, "Yep, I paid my ticket. Let's take that home. Let's watch it again when we get home."
And do you know who did that? That was actually done back in the late 80s. CEL, the releasing company, they were the first company in Australia to introduce sell-through video. Things like 2010 and The Sure Thing and so forth were in their first batch of releases. Yeah, they were released in cardboard boxes like
America.
I have
a bunch of those,
The original CEL releases. They were released in 1999. They were sell-through price. This was a time when buying a VHS cassette cost $130 because they were only for video shops, right? So they came up with this idea of sell-through model, and it was very successful for them. Then they bought a series of cinemas, one of them being the Dendy, I think it was called? Was it a Dendy? The one that is now the Star Bar, the one that went downstairs.
Yeah, that was a Dendy.
Yeah, that Dendy was owned by CEL. And what they did was they would actually release the VHS sell-through movie at the same date. They would put it into their movie cinema and they would release it. One example, this is Sean Penn, Madonna, Shanghai Surprise. It was actually for sale in the lobby at the movies when you could actually buy it. The cinema chains like Hoyts and Grady Union and Village at the time lost their fucking nut and basically said, how dare you release the same day? Where's our window? Why would anybody ever go to the cinema if they can just buy a VHS tape straight off the way? They boycotted everything to do with CEL, and CEL went under in the end because the major chains were absolutely insistent on windows. And at that time, we're talking about a 12-month window.
It was, and keep in mind, back in the 80s, it was a good 12-month window before
that
window.
That window shrunk to 6 months when pay TV came out, because when Foxtel came out, the VHS window went to 6 months and then 12 months for pay TV.
And now we're looking at an average of 3 to 4 months.
Absolutely,
there are a lot of things juggling here. I think like we all feel that the internet is the future of distribution.
Yes,
like whether we like it or not, I think it's going to happen.
Whether we have a speed tier or not.
Yeah, like let me finish this out. I'll be a little bit long, but I'll finish it out.
No, please go.
Like the thing is that, you know, if given the choice to sit at home and watch it at home, most people are probably going to take that. So I think that's going to be the future. We're going to watch movies at home in the same way we do Netflix, the same way we do everything that we consume. Because the thing is that now television quality has gotten to the point that's almost as equal as going to the movies. Things like Game of Thrones, Walking Dead. The thing is, if I have a choice of going to the movies or staying at home, it's probably going to be staying at home with the public, right? Playing the devil's advocate. That's not what I believe, but...
They're the place for the cinema experience. And
second point is that maybe 10 years ago, nobody in the world would have said, you know, film's going to be dead. It died. It's gone. Like, whether we want to admit that or not.
The actual medium of
film. The actual 35, right? It's gone. And this is an interesting thing that Nolan brought up, was that ironically, it could be 35mm film that saves cinema. Because here's the final point is that what people choose not to talk about when discussing this box office analysis is that half the money earned goes to the distributors, to the theater owners, to the chains. Because the multiplexes, the chains, they have to fund rent, electricity, staff, payroll, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They only make half. So the thing is that we're at this impasse now where the general public are going to the movies and they're at home watching stuff at home, right? What happens when theater owners can no longer afford to open theaters and the medium is in the air?
Well, the funny thing is that's
the question, because like the public is going to choose what happens to the future of cinema exhibition. And I have a feeling that it's on the verge of collapsing.
Funny thing is, I'm old enough to remember now. I agree to you to a point, but let's look at history, because this is why I think history is always so important, because history, we tend to repeat history. And I think having a look at history, whatever your particular passions lie in. When I was teaching IT studies, I would always teach history of IT. And they'd always go, why are you teaching me about, you know, where the first computers came out, is because if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat failure. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm old enough to remember the 1980s very clearly. Now, in the early 1980s, I was in Victoria, I was in Melbourne, we had cinemas everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, we are talking about cinemas in every little hidey hole where you could fit a cinema. And over the course of the decade, with the advent of home video, we saw all those cinemas close. To the point where we were literally left within the city, because that's where you went to the movies. Now you can't even go to the movies in the city, as we found out.
While in Melbourne. You've got the central.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking that most of all the major cinemas are gone that I remember there. But anyway, the point is that we actually saw all of the small cinemas close because home video basically killed it. And all that we were left was the three majors, basically. What happened was a very interesting turn of events, though. And that interesting turn of events was people got saturated with home video and then went, you know what? I think I'd actually like to go out to the movies. Mm-hmm. And we saw a resurgence in people going back to the movies because suddenly they went, home video is this, but now I'd like to go actually experience going out to the movies. And so people started to go back to the movies and we started to see cinemas reopen. Mm-hmm. We started to see cinemas all over the place, multiplexes popping up in all the malls and everything, because everybody suddenly wanted to go back to the movies. And now we're reaching the end of that cycle and we're starting to see cinemas close again.
I got two more points.
So the point is that I think what we're going to see is everything comes in cycles. We're going to see this whole home cinema surge go through. We're going to see cinemas close again. We're going to see weird things happen at the cinemas. Every gimmick raised, shooting parts of it in IMAX and all the various gimmicks that come and go, to the point where they're going to stop doing all of that eventually because they're going to say, that's irrelevant on home video and that's where the market is. Everybody will then get to a certain point with home video where they're going to go, you know what? I don't want to watch it on my laptop screen. I want to go back to the cinema and we will see cinemas reopen again. And you know what? You can tell this happens because mainstays like the Astor still kick. You know, there is still a place where people can still experience it.
Two more points for me. Like there's an adage in engineering that the more parts that a machine has, the more likely it is to break.
Correct.
Mm. And the thing is that in the history, right, the history of this medium is that the parts of the machine are that books go into bookstores, DVDs go into DVD stores, movies go into cinemas. That's the parts of the machine. Now the machine is all these working parts, some of them we can't even define, some of them we don't even know what they're going to do. And so now we're at this sort of weird area. And there's two more things that I feel I need to mention. I know we're running really over time.
That's okay. It's cool.
Whatever.
But, we have no rules on this show.
So first is the quality of the products, right? So like Netflix, in Behind the Panels previously, we were talking about the whole Netflix shows. Marvel Netflix shows. And the thing is that like, they could have gone to ABC, they could have gone to any of the networks, but they went to Netflix, right? And because I have the feeling that that's because of the creative freedom and the control that they're allowed.
Yeah.
And the kind of thing is that you look at the amount of filmmakers that have moved to television. Scorsese's planted feet with Boardwalk Empire, Fincher with House of Cards. Mm. The list goes on and on and on and on.
Well, Spielberg
is one of the first people to actually jump into television.
Yeah, with Taken and stuff
with
like that.
Amblin Entertainment, everything.
And the pick we'll be talking about this week, Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro with The Strain.
Like they're all doing it. And I feel this is their version of a safety net. Because it's sort of like all the quality creators are moving away from cinema. Let me finish. Sorry, Dave. Yeah. Is that because like when you're dealing with a $200 million budget, you end up with a Pacific Rim scenario. Sorry, Richard, you're pointing. You're ending up with a scenario where, all this amount of money is spent, the creator struggles for 3 years and nothing's done, whereas you can go to television, they welcome you with open arms. Second point, the final point is that over the last year, we've had... 2 weeks ago, we had Christopher Nolan wrote an entire article about this in the Wall Street Journal. Months ago, you had Steven Soderbergh did a speech. There was the famous thing about how Lucas and Spielberg together, and I quote, that the industry is imploding. Like now that we're in this world where in the span of a year, you've had the big people that created this industry as we know it today talking about its impending demise and we need to do something about it. And the kind of thing is that now with all these parts in this machine... Like, we need to strip it back and really fix it or
Something. However, I'm going to throw one little spanner in that argument. And it's not that I don't agree.
I'm playing devil's advocate.
Not that I don't agree with you, because I do agree with you that it is imploding. However, I find it ironic that Spielberg and Lucas and Scorsese and all of the major players today are talking about how the industry is imploding and they're looking for the next thing. Whereas if history, once again, I'm old. Once again, you go back to history and you look at the mid-1970s, and all of the old school guard at that time were basically complaining about people like Scorsese and Spielberg and so forth, who were changing the face of cinema, and the industry was basically being taken over by these wonder kids, and how dare they? Mm. This is not how Hollywood works.
Okay, another point. Sorry, I got so much to say about this. Like one thing as well.
We
is
don't
like,
have to fit it all in one show.
Yeah. We're at 40 minutes already. That's amazing.
I know.
But like say for example, like Hollywood needing to rely on $200+ million films. That means there's going to be an over-reliance on franchises, right? So like, are franchises going to be the cornerstones of the future Hollywood? Maybe, quite possibly. It's just going to be nothing but sequels and big overblown studio like extravaganzas, right? Like Waterworld you mentioned before, to bring it back to that. Because the kind of thing is like, we're talking about these wonder kids that created an industry, right? They in my opinion at least, they created it with original ideas and their own franchises. Now, like, you know, let's take the Star Wars spin-offs as a perfect example of this situation, where like for ages the auteurs of late are named. Like Rian Johnson, wow, he's going to change the future of cinema. Rian Johnson, Josh Trank, Chronicle, what an outstanding thing. You know, Zack Snyder, wow. Like Gareth Edwards, Monsters, that was a revolutionary film. What happens is all these potential wonder kids, these auteurs, are now, all of them are involved in Star Wars.
Yeah. Mm.
And so this is the kind of thing, it's like...
Or big budget motion
films. Or Marvel films.
All of those, like, you know, Gareth Edwards went straight to Godzilla. Mm. And it's kind of like he followed up a really promising... original film with like a franchise film.
Mm. Yeah, and Trank and Trank is going into Fantastic Four,
which, you know, despite the fact that they've recast it to make it more interesting, it's basically a franchise film. Yeah. We know what it's going to look like, more or less. So yeah,
and it's dangerous. It's a really rocky road, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the industry. I don't think there's...
Which is cool why Marvel sort of doesn't get the big names to do their films.
Well, and also not getting the big names is also, this is a trick that Lucas learned a long time ago, because when he made The Phantom Menace, he had a budget of $75 million and he adhered.
No, he managed to get for the prequel trilogy. He managed to get George Lucas for all of those.
But he said, even though I'm funding it myself, he said, we have a budget, and this is the budget
we're
adhere to.
It's so crazy. It's like that, and then there's, and then I mean, there's Hollywood about, fucking over the visual effects artists.
Yeah, but
it's
think about that number for a minute, guys. Phantom Menace, like it or hate it, I don't care. Think about what that film looks like. Think about how beautifully made that film is. $75 million in a time when the average Hollywood budget was $120, $130 million. Yeah. Lucas knows
it helped that he owned all the production houses.
Sure, but he still but he still paid for them.
Yeah, that's true.
Because if you actually watch the behind the scenes of that, they would come to him with budgets and say, this is what it's going to cost you to do Jar Jar Binks, for instance. And they actually gave him cost
analysis.
But
I'm sure ILM would put the cost up when they're doing external work.
Possibly. But the point is that he still could do it on that sort of money.
Yeah.
And the point is that if you can produce that kind of film, how does he do that? Because he doesn't cast huge, big names. And yes, does that sometimes hinder the performances?
Yeah,
maybe. But the point
Hayden
is...
Hayden Christensen, real fine.
No, I will tell on that, sir.
I was actually not thinking of Hayden Christensen. I was thinking about...
Mustafa No, what's his name?
I was thinking about the kid.
Oh, Jake Lloyd.
Jake Lloyd, yeah. There was a
fucking scary looking if you've seen him lately.
All right. We are 45 minutes into this show. So let's move on a little bit, because we do have to talk about what we've been watching. But before that, something fun that Dave found. Because last week we talked about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and we said that the soundtrack hadn't come out yet. We were really annoyed.
Yeah.
The soundtrack is now available on iTunes. So I went out and bought it and it's fantastic. But so in celebrating the release of the soundtrack, Dave found this.
It's the adorable moment art and life collide. Two-year-old Chips, Vali, and Sigriva seen here at a movie theater in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina for the weekend premiere of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And much like their cinematic counterparts, these chimps are clearly highly evolved, buying their own tickets for the show and even paying for their popcorn and juice after walking right up the stairs and presenting their tickets.
And then killing the usher.
They were ready for the show.
I'm sorry, my friend.
During the film, the chimps respond like many humans. Sagreeva turning away during a dramatic scene, Vali clenching his companion's hand, and both clap for the good guys and bark at the bad, while still managing to get their popcorn fix. Some viewers were concerned, asking the Safari's director if the chimps should really be watching and learning how to take over the world. But he says as smart as the chimps are, real-life guerrilla warfare is unlikely. For Good Morning America, Paula Ferris, ABC News, New York.
And that aren't they so funny?
Wasn't monkeying around.
Oh.
It looks like cinema's gone bananas.
I think training the chimpanzees by getting to watch these counterparts is probably not a good idea.
No. But to their credit, what part they didn't show in that story was the part where they flung their own feces at a trailer for sex tape. Which to be fair, is exactly what I did when I saw...
That's true.
We went and saw sex tape.
What have we been watching, Richard?
Oh, shit, my thing's not open.
What are you doing? You're killing me, man. You're killing me.
I'm watching you, Wazowski. Always watch.
We'll keep this real short.
Yeah. We saw a sex tape this week. We didn't
Enough
pay
said.
To say it. Look, can I just say my one thing about that is that just mentioning the word sex a lot in the film does not make you edgy.
No.
In fact, it was probably the tamest film I've seen. It's kind of like it wants to be an Apatow kind of edgy comedy without actually committing to anything explicit.
I was actually really disheartened to find out that it was written by Siegel and his writing partner. His name has gone out of my head.
Not Nicholas Stoller.
Stoller, yes.
It was written by Stoller
and Siegel.
They should stick to Muppets.
Who are better than this material. Yeah. It was also written by Jake Kasdan. It was directed by Jake Kasdan, who is also well above this material. And so you sit there and you go, what the hell went wrong? You know, it's like the whole film is moralizing.
It was an ad for Apple.
Yes.
It was an ad for...
Which, ironically, from a Sony film.
From a Sony film. It was an ad for YouPorn as well. There was a whole big thing about YouPorn.
And let's face it, it got an R rating purely because the word...
Yeah. There's a whole sequence set in the YouPorn building at the end. It's very strange.
Yeah, and look, I'm...
what?
I won't spoil... For those...
That's youporn.com.
I haven't seen it, by the
but
way.
For those three people that actually want to go see this movie, I won't spoil the cameo.
No.
But I will say that it's the cameo at the YouPorn who drops the word cunt, which is obviously why it got its R rating, because nothing else in this film would have got it an R rating.
And now we've got an R rating for the show. This is the second week in a row that we've used the word cunt. I actually got...
We carry an explicit tag.
a text from a good friend, John D, who said, can't believe you used the word cunt on the show last week. And I was like, well, we couldn't tell your story without using it.
Yeah,
what's wrong?
And the word cunt is just a word, people. You know,
it's a word we seem to have agreed upon as a people that is a bad word.
Yeah,
this is Australia, mate.
You know, words don't hurt people. People hurt people.
Yes, absolutely. So look, we do carry an explicit tag, and that's one of the reasons, because, I mean, do you know what? This word is used in the world. You know, get over it. And the more you are offended by words, the more the power those words hold. So if you're not offended by them, they hold no power. Now, the point that I wanted to make about this film was that the only thing that
and it's
I...
it's not like you guys said it first. It was in the movie.
Absolutely. And the only reason why... Absolutely. Thank you, Dave. The only reason that this film at all, in any way whatsoever, had any... redeeming feature was the fact that I will say that it's actually the best Cameron Diaz has looked in a long time.
Yeah, she's not quite as harsh or plastic.
Yeah, she looked. She didn't
straddle any windshields.
No,
in this one.
And
what
if
was
you,
that
and
you messaged
about
me?
To say if you saw Bad Teacher, she looked like a leather handbag.
Yes,
and
no, she really did.
She really did. She looked horrible, and this she actually looks. like the Cameron Diaz that we all kind of fell in love
with. She kind of starting to look her age again. She was looking good 50, 60 years older.
Yeah, she was.
Can you guys tell me, though, what's in the sex tape? Because I've seen that trailer and it's like, what are they doing, a circus
routine? Well, you don't see
or like,
you don't
apparently,
see it on,
apparently they make love for 3 hours.
In every position.
And they get the joy of sex and they do every position in the joy of sex.
Okay,
and you see, you kind of see there's almost hangover moment towards the end where they go through and look at some of the tape, but it's the most, it's like, you know, it's clearly the most, it's the tamest sex scene.
It's the most unerotic stuff. And yeah. The thing is, the joke of this is supposed to be that it is actually supposed to be so hot that at one point their friends see like literally seconds of it
and end up humping in the car
because they get so hot over this thing. And you sit there and go, wow.
That's really weird, though, when you think about
this. This must be really a hot, be a really hot video.
My best friend.
Oh, hang on. We're going to mention Rob Lowe, though.
Oh, Rob Lowe.
Rob Lowe has a cameo, and it's like he steps straight out of the 80s. He's actually doing lines of Lowe in the film.
Yes.
And it's
Is
just,
Rob Lowe the cameo you were talking
about?
No. Rob Lowe's established early on and think he's like Cameron Diaz's boss. Like, she's trying to sell her blog to
fucking blogger.
This movie like should have been made 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe it was really
blogs are edgy.
How many candy coated dildos out of 5 are you gonna give this film?
I would give this like if I could give it half of a broken candy colored dildo, I would. But I'm gonna give it one firmly shoved where it don't belong.
And I will be a little bit more generous because it's not the worst film I've ever seen. It's just not. Look, quite frankly, as a comedy, we've said this before on the Film Actually Show, the Geek Actually Show, and now we'll say it here. The worst sin a comedy can commit.
Oh, it's boring.
Is not being funny.
Did you guys laugh more than 6 times?
I counted. I laughed, what, once? I remember laughing out loud once.
Look, I kind of gave out a couple of little, a couple of times just because some of the little sequences
were
cute.
There was a few chuckles. I laughed out loud once. I can't remember what the joke was.
I can't even remember either. Yeah. Look, I'm going to give it 2. It is below average. Mm. I would not spend cinema dollars on it, but, you know, it might be worth looking as a rental.
So you can at least DP with your candy colored dildo.
Yes.
I've got one that I'm shoving in firmly and then breaking off.
You just got to watch for sharp edges on a candy coated dildo.
Yeah, mine broke off halfway through.
Yeah. All right. So the other thing that we did watch this week, which...
This movie fucked the stump.
I did watch the documentary...
That would have been amazing on the sex day, hey? If that was what...
Oh, that's God. My ball she, quote, by the
she,
way.
She takes off a prosthetic leg. And
sex tape DVD release. It'll be like, this movie fucks the stump. Richard Gray, Geek Movie Club.
I think we should, at this point, I think we should mention that tweet that went out today, which I got a picture of, which was an IMAX cinema. It was an IMAX, the sign on an IMAX cinema in America, and the two films playing were right on top of each other, so it actually read Transformers Sex Tape, and I thought that was brilliant.
Sorry, speaking of stupid apes, I noticed that on this video, Chimps Attend Dawn of the Planet of the Apes screening, one of the other suggested videos is Jenny McCarthy on vaccines.
Oh dear. Look, I also saw the documentary Room 237, but that is going to spark a much bigger debate. So I'm going to save that. We're going to shelve that
sequel.
One. We're going to shelve Room 237 for another show.
That'll be in our next episode. Dawn of the Planet of the Candy Colored.
What I will say about Room 237 is if you want to know
we'll make that for you, Richard.
If you want to know what we're talking about, because I think everybody here has seen it.
Dildo.
Watch Room 237 before the next show is all I'm going to say, so that we have something to talk about. But what we are going to talk about, I think you've got a clip for us as well, don't you?
From what?
From Guillermo del Toro's new television series.
We do.
And you've got a clip for this.
I do, and I will play this clip.
Hunger, a poet once said, is the most important thing we know, the first lesson we learn. But hunger can be easily quieted down, easily satiated. There is another force, a different type of hunger, an unquenchable thirst that cannot be extinguished. Its very existence is what defines us, what makes us human. That force is love.
It's a good clip.
It's a good clip.
It is. You give good clip, dude. Dave, Guillermo del Toro is your your wheelhouse.
He's your hero.
You're Del Toro. That's what I say. You're Del Toro's bitch at this point.
Yeah. Before I hand over to you, what we'll do is we'll just give a quick summary here, which is The Strain was originally proposed as a TV series back in about 2008. Right. It was rejected. They say, and his agent, Guillermo del Toro's agent, basically suggested that he do it as a book. He then wrote a trilogy, The Strain, The Fall, and...
Damn, I can't remember off the top of my head.
No, I can't either. Anyway, The Strain was one, The Fall was another, and then the third book in the series, which I can't remember.
Oh, man.
And The Strain came
out... I've only read the first one, so I don't know.
The Strain came out in 2009 as a book. It was then later adapted to being a comic book, which is up to its second volume now.
The Night Eternal.
Thank you. So in comic books in 2011, it was turned into the comic books The Strain, The Strain, The Fall, and they are proposing the third one as well, which will come out. And I think they said that by the end it's going to be 24 issues or something like that by the time it's all finished. Now, jet forward a little bit, 2014, he's finally come full circle and he's turned it into a TV series for FX. Mm. Now, with all that being said, Dave, tell us about The Strain.
I won't go on for too long because I feel exhausted from talking about all that film stuff before. But speaking of television being better than movies, I think we can all agree that maybe TV this week was better than film was.
Kind of.
Yeah. Well, if the competition was sex tape.
Yeah. imagine if The Strain had involved a sex tape in some way.
Maybe that'll happen.
That would have been. Yeah, we might have that one. But
spoilers.
I'll just be really, really brief. I mean, I'd read the book going into this, and I'm a massive Guillermo del Toro fanboy. So surprise, surprise, I thought it was magnificent. And that's like.
I mean, the thing is, to set the scene for people. It starts as like looks like it's going to be a viral outbreak thing, and then it becomes something else, something more horror oriented, which you'd expect from del Toro.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
So I mean, look. Long story short, we're all talking about this beforehand. I thought it started a little slow. After the first 5 minutes, literally, it was too safe. Mm. And that's literally only because I think, and Dave, you suggested this beforehand, it was kind of like the network just kind of going, let's just put a safety net here. And then once it kicks into gear, once that horror element kicks into gear, boy, does it fly.
Yeah. Yes.
Boy, is it good. And
I totally felt that way too, because the beginning of the film is the
episode.
The pilot, I suppose, is that like the plane lands on the tarmac, it's black, all the windows are closed. There's no like readings of heat. There's nothing. Mm. So the CDC are called, you know, who's on board this plane? What's the story? And that's where it begins. Whereas in the book, I think, and Dave said it was in the comic.
Yeah, the comic book. I've read the comic book, which is, it sounds a lot like it's a lot closer to the book, which actually starts years ago. In the case of the book, I believe it goes back even further. But in the comic book, it actually starts at when... What's his character's name again?
Abraham Satrakian.
Satrakian is a child.
Quirky names.
And he's
played by the terrific David Bradley.
Mm. Oh, and he's fantastic. So, and he's basically the Van Helsing of this particular story. He is a child and he is being told the fable of the tall man.
So did you want an interesting bit of trivia about that? Recurring del Toro collaborator John Hurt played the character in the pilot, but later dropped out. His scenes were reshot by Bradley.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
John Hurt would have been perfect.
He would have been
Not saying that this guy was bad. This guy was great.
No, he was great. And for those
John Hurt,
those who go, I know that actor. Why do I know his actor? He was Filch in the Harry Potter films.
Yeah. And he also played
Hellboy. He was in Hellboy.
And he played William Hartnell in the Adventures in Time and Space documentary. Sort of drama.
He's a terrific actor who I'm glad to see is getting much more work now. Mm. So, but he basically, in the comic book, he's a child. He's being told the story of this tall man who was muscularly weak, who would give toys and gifts and stuff to the kids, and then on a wolf hunt or something like that, basically, where his father is convinced that the blood of the wolf and the meat of the wolf will make him strong. They go out on this hunt, and then he's never the same after
and
that.
And it's in the novel, it's incredibly eerie.
Yeah, and the children start to disappear. It's written
read the novel.
You really should. Yeah. I should complete them too. That's almost written as a Grimm's fairy tale.
Yeah, well, that's how it comes
across.
Especially
how it's written in the prose. It reads just like a fable that, you know,
which you
Del
can
Toro
see
would
is where
love.
Exactly the Del Toro stuff was. Because even when there's this coffin thing that they find in the plane, and the way that it's carved and the look of it looks like something straight out of a fairy tale, straight out of a storybook. It looks like the edges of an old
storybook. If you're a nutcase Del Toro fan like I am, like, You sort of know what colors he uses and what they mean, and like you've heard him talk at length about like his stylistic choices, and they're in every single frame.
One thing that really jumped out at me is that there's during one of the first gory kind of deaths when he's walking through that corridor in the airport and the kind of the loading dock area, and the first death occurs. The lighting of that, there's this kind of orangey kind of thing to it, and then the way that the color of the water or blood across the floor and the patterns that was in, that really struck me as something visually interesting you don't see on TV.
Rarely. Yeah. It's like a moving painting.
Yes,
you know,
and the way that spoilers the creature, let's just say, moves off at the end of that, all flailing, almost as though it's made of cloth somehow.
Yeah,
you know, and I love that visually.
We should also stress that Del Toro actually directed the pilot.
Yeah, and wrote the pilot as well.
So this is actually very much a Del Toro thing. The only criticism I
just wanted to quickly say, because we should go maybe in order of the show, I suppose, like, and get to the cast, but just on that, like, plane, the sequence at the beginning in the book, it's drawn out a lot longer, and it's more eerie, and it's very.
I can see, like, how
what
that would
the
work,
shit is going on here. Mm. And I read that book in a time where I didn't know it was vampires even when I began.
Yeah.
You know, and the kind of thing is, I picked it up because it's like, crap, Del Toro wrote a book? Like, are you kidding? Like, that was the reason to read it. And so reading that book not knowing what's coming is incredible. Yeah. And especially when he draws it out over something like 50, 60 pages, like this, like, investigation of a plane, and you yourself don't know what's going on. Whereas in the show, they raced it.
No, they raced it
really quickly.
And that's actually one of the downfalls of the show.
And that's where I got a little bit concerned, but it was so cool.
Because I really liked the show. I really enjoyed the 70-minute pilot. I thought it was a really tight show. My only concern over it, and the only thing that I thought was the weakest part of the show, was the airplane stuff. Because having been a huge Fringe watcher, that's almost exactly how Fringe starts. A plane lands, everybody's dead in it, blah. And so you sit there and you go, wait a minute, this feels like we're right back where we started from. And had they started this series the way that the comic book adaptation starts and the way the book starts, it would have been a better opening.
Devil's advocate,
to bring us in,
so to speak. Devil's advocate with that. If you had started with all that backstory, all that exposition with the ancient stuff, would that have slowed down the pace of the pilot far too much?
Maybe.
Because you get one shot.
You get one shot
at a pilot.
Richard, I wouldn't even be surprised if he filmed it that way.
Possibly,
and they cut it or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you look at the way, and a completely different genre, but look at the way that Arrow has dealt with exposition. They could have done the whole first episode as Oliver Queen on the island.
True.
But no, they've decided to meter that out over the course of the seasons.
And this is
because
this
it worked narratively,
television.
It works better.
And it's a pilot too. Like, they'll come back with more money, and they'll come back with, like, bigger sets.
I'm very curious to see the rest of the series.
And, and it's cast impeccably, in my opinion.
Corey Stoll is terrific.
But you can see Del Toro-isms all throughout it. Like that's the stuff that makes the book so rich. And I wish there would be more in the show.
Sean Astin's in this, we should point out.
Sean Astin's character is not in the book, from my memory.
Oh, really?
That's an addition. But he's a good character in the show. I'm intrigued by what they're doing there.
See, and what intrigues me is...
I just wanted to quickly mention that the milk, drinking the milk in the crime scene. Like, that's...
Got your milk.
Such a Del Toro thing. Like, But there's all
keep
sorts
it cold
of
for me.
Like, having read the book, I think, like, is a good position to be in on this episode, because there's all these things littered throughout it. Like, you guys probably noticed, like, posters of the upcoming eclipse.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, there's all sorts of little details in the background. And this is something Del Toro does in Pacific Rim, where we got to remember that Del Toro never, ever takes it completely seriously. Like, it's always tongue-in-cheek, it's always pulpy fun. So even when it seems to be slowing down, he'll put something in the foreground and the background to entertain you. And so, looking at the shots in The Strain, there's always something going on in the background that's related to something coming on. And so I have a feeling that in the coming weeks, people are going to return to the pilot and be even more impressed.
Yeah, go back with the freeze frame.
Totally,
Another actor we need to single out is Jonathan Hyde, Australian-born British actor. Yeah.
Richie Rich.
Look, he's been in so many films. You recognize him. He was in Titanic. He was in Jumanji, as you said, Richie Rich. He was also in Anaconda.
Was he really?
but he is just plays this impeccably dressed, you know, rich man, or, you know, enigmatic sort of. He's the elderly billionaire character, and his story is, I get the impression, is not yet done.
Yeah,
it's just beginning. Despite the fact that he's at the end of his life, I get the impression his story is just beginning.
Well, that entire organization, I think, is coming back
into
it.
Shit goes down pretty soon. Yeah,
because they keep talking about the end. I want to see the. I want to indulge an elderly man as I walk the streets before the end or something.
Totally, yeah. Well, I would almost say, like, I'm not going to spoil, obviously, but like at the end of the first book, shit goes down to such a point where you question, where can this go from here?
Well, okay. It goes to called The Fall, apparently.
Yeah, well, that probably hints, like, strongly.
Well, they actually mentioned The Fall in this pilot.
But shit goes down a lot quicker than you think it will.
Yeah.
That's not spoiling too much.
Well, they actually talk about the coming of The Fall. Mm. So we're waiting for that. And the second comic book series is called The Fall. The second book is called The Fall. So there's a lot coming.
There's so much thought put into it, I think. Del Toro seems to do this all the time, where he sort of begins the movies or the stories in very cliche territories and then changes things slightly and subtly. And then all of a sudden the rug's gone. Like, for example, like the heart in the jar, like that is more designed and conceptualized than like anything else. Like on television, I mean, not in the episodes, like that he'll do something in a shot that has more thought put into it than like entire movies. This is why I love him. Because I do that nutcase thing where I overanalyze every second. And most people just flick through.
Say this when you've got a copy of Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities on the table. The good news about this series is it's running on FX in the States. It's 13 episodes first season, not a single break. There's no mid-season breaks or everything. The date just runs straight through October 12th, which for FX, I think, is about the time Walking Dead season 5 kicks off. So this is basically their lead-in.
But Walking Dead's AMC.
That's right. It's FX in
America.
Maybe
Sons of Anarchy.
You're right. Sons of Anarchy. I could be thinking of. Yeah. Sorry, I get mixed up because it's Walking Dead screens on FX in Australia.
That's correct.
So that's where I'm thinking.
Yeah, in America, it's AMC.
Absolutely right. But the point is, we run straight through with this one, so there won't be any of that. For those who want in the middle of the season,
for those who want to watch this, it's on Foxtel. It's on FX, as we said.
Fast track from the US.
Fast track from the US. If you don't have Foxtel and you are using something like what's it called, Hola on Ola. On Chrome, you can watch it on Hulu. Apparently, it's on Hulu. There are ways to see this. Hola and Hulu are gray areas, but it's not technically piracy. It's not illegal, so you know, go for it. But if you are on Foxtel, this is the way to watch it. It's in high def. It looks great. So I'm really eager to see the rest of the series. I'm also in the middle of reading the comic book series, so it is really interesting to read it and see it as it's happening. Whether I go back and read the book or not, I'm not sure at this point, because my curiosity is this: if it was originally proposed as a TV series, then turned into a novel, then turned into a comic book, and now it's come back to television, how much of that original TV series is in this TV series, and how much of this is now based on his books?
Ideas have evolved, obviously.
This is now obviously based on the book that he has written, as opposed to the original TV series that he originally proposed. So it'll be interesting to know how much has changed.
And we'll see what happens, because it's going into the hands of Carlton Cuse,
right?
Who was the co-creator of Lost, and the co-showrunner, not the creator. And so that's interesting. Like, we know how Lost went, and I loved Lost personally. I have a feeling that it's in safe hands.
But remember, Guillermo del Toro will still stay on as executive producer. Yeah. So he's still there. Yeah. He may not be directing,
but all the hard work's done. Like, you got Peter. Like, we were talking before about directors on TV.
Yeah.
Like Peter Berg with The Leftovers.
Yeah,
like comes in, directs the pilot, sets the tone. Or House of Cards,
Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah, and Wonderland for some nerds of TV. But yeah. But that's the thing. It's like Del Toro comes in, sets the tone, casts it impeccably.
Kevin Smith at Reaper,
totally, exactly. Yeah. You know?
They set the tone, they get everything going, and then allow somebody else to take it over after that. Mm. We see this a lot.
I hope Carlton Cuse brings to it the same style that he brought to The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., Nash Bridges, and Martial Law.
The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. was awesome. Yeah. that was the Bruce Campbell series, dude.
All those shows
was
awesome. Been around
for a long time then.
He did that. He also did Black Sash. He did Lost, of course.
Did any of you see The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.?
Yeah.
This is the old Bruce Campbell series that was comedy western. It was awesome. It only lasted one season, I think. It was short-lived, but it was really funny.
And we should just mention the creature effects.
Look, the effects are great, especially
all practical,
considering...
Most, yeah. m- for
well,
the most
not
part.
The, not
for the most
part. Swirling
But well, how could they do that for real?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But a lot of it's really good. And let's not forget that opening yeah. introduction scene for the Van Helsing character, whose name is out of my head already.
Satrakian.
That sequence in the pawn shop where the guys try and rob him is sensational.
Mm. He basically is an old man in his 80s who takes down two armed punks.
Yeah. And then the guy steals the clock on the way out.
Yeah.
I thought that was genius.
But I'm taking this clock.
I love it. And then he literally pops the last bullet out of it and puts it in the drawer with all the other weapons.
Yeah. Last word for me, I guess, is that I feel that Guillermo del Toro's worlds, they always have a world outside the frame.
Mm.
Like, and the world outside the frame for me is just...
feels lived in.
Yeah. Well, totally, but I'm meaning in a more joking, loving way, like that I have the sense that I always picture Guillermo del Toro standing by the side of the frame, just giggling, yeah. Laughing, like, "Oh, this is so good." You know, like that's
well, evident by if you go back for those film nerds out there, and if you're listening to the show, you probably are. If you go back and watch the making of Blade 2. There is actually a sequence in it where they're doing costume tests and Guillermo del Toro is actually narrating the costume test. And there's one point where the guy's got all this fucking white hair and everything. Guillermo del Toro starts laughing. And he goes, "Look at this fucking guy." It's one of the funniest things. So yes, I agree with you. Yeah. I think he's, it's almost like his own private joke is going on in the background.
So I guess what we're saying is do what you have to do, catch up with episode one and keep watching season two before going forward.
And we'll keep talking about it as it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Damn. And Del Toro has said he's predicted 3 to 5 seasons. So that's what he's aiming for.
And Richard, you said the ratings, I think, before you mentioned.
Pilot episode, 8 million viewers, which is, and we're talking Walking Dead numbers are like, so this is cable as well, basic cable. Walking Dead numbers are like 10 to 13 million. And
so it's up there.
Yeah, so it's up. It's 8. We'll put it this way. The average episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. got 5 to 6 million.
Yeah.
So, and that's on network television.
That's a good sign. So, that's a real good sign.
Yeah.
All right. So I think we need to bring this clubhouse to a close. Remember, next week there is no GMC. There will be a film, actually, because we'll get really serious about films like we just did.
We didn't get that serious.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
Anything you guys want to add before we're going out?
Yeah, I'd like to bring up the issue.
shut up. Oh, I think we've got a sound for that.
Oh, that. Oh, fuck that.
Anyway.
We're not going to talk about Jenny McCarthy's stance on Buckingham.
No. We need a segment where we just rattle off the names of shows we've watched.
We will give this a close.
Torchwood.
Yeah. Fargo. 24.
24 finished, yeah?
It did. It was amazing.
Good, strong season.
One of the best they've done, I think. Like, actually, quickly, being 12 episodes this time instead of 24, I think really helped.
So it was only 12-hour day.
So the series shouldn't be called 12.
No, actually, interestingly enough, it was a 12-hour day, like 12 hours of a day, and then the last episode jumped. Near the end, it jumped to the morning.
Oh, okay.
So it did the whole day.
Interesting. So they kind of shortchanged the audience over 24.
Well, I'd be interested to see how it was. Well, they did, but I mean,
to be fair, it's probably one of the few seasons you could watch in real time.
I don't think they did shortchange the audience because we all thought for a long time it was going to be a movie,
right?
Instead of coming back,
and then so it would have been a 24-hour movie.
That would have been a long ass movie.
Yeah, well, that's probably why they didn't.
It was made by Andy Warhol, I believe.
Yeah. Supposedly, at one point they were going to cross over 24 with Die Hard.
Oh god,
oh, shit. And,
yeah, that's how bad things got at Fox.
And on that note, we're gonna wrap this episode up. You can catch up with any back episodes of this or any other show that we do at geekactually.com. Be looking on the Geek Actually Super Feed and the Film Actually feed for Film Actually next week. That'll be episode 101 and the return of Josh Philpott. God, I hope all this comes to plan. Otherwise, it's a lot of pre-planning for nothing. In the meantime, Richard, where can people find more of you?
On the Twitters at DVDBits, therealbits.com. It's my website, also, of course, behindthepanels.net.
Fantastic.
Twitter at Dave Longo.
Just Twitter? No, you don't want to...
Yeah, well, you can go to damngoodcup.com.
But you never update it.
Yeah, can't
be bothered. If you feel, because look, you got the Twin Peaks Blu-rays coming out.
Oh, yeah.
In about a week or two. So if you're feeling all things Twin Peaks, go to Damn Good Cup.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just always recommend, like, Pacific Rim. If you have it on Blu-ray, DVD, check out the commentary. Seriously.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
And you can do it.
And get this book, Cabinet of Curiosities, Guillermo del Toro's Notebooks.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful book.
It is a beautiful book. I can see it from here. It looks fun. All right. You can find out more.
That should be the name of the episode. I can see it from here. It looks fun.
It looks fun. I think you just nailed it. You can find me on Twitter.
I bet you could call Jenny McCarthy on vaccines.
You can find me on Twitter at Dave McVeigh. Of course, you can find me at geekactually.com. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us just about everywhere. So just have a hunt around.
The internet.
Find us.
You can find us on the internet.
You can find us on the internet. We've been doing this for 6 years. You do a search, you will find us.
I'm going to use it as a pickup line. Hey, just Google me.
Google me, baby.
look me up on YouPorn.
We want a small dick man. Yeah. Tries his best.
I was referencing Rob Lowe, but
and I think do you have music for us to go?
I do have music for us to
go. Alright, so on that note. We'll call this meeting to a close. Richard, take us out.
Touching me. Touching you. Don't seem so long.